Thank you, Rick. That was that's a very nice introduction, and I think I would say that Rick and I didn't just come together at Yale. We sort of washed up there together at Yale, to use your seashore metaphors. And it's been a delight knowing Rick ever since, and many other people in this room as well. So I feel like I've sort of come back to almost a family gathering in coming here. So thank you very much for inviting me. And nice to see you.
I forgot to mention, tomorrow at 12:10 in 6 Olson, Tom will be giving the Animal Behavior Seminar too. Tom, I don't remember the title of that seminar.
It's the flight guidance mechanisms of honeybee swarms. It's the follow-up to this one where we're going to be looking at how a swarm of bees chooses its home, and they make the decision, and then tomorrow we'll look at how they implement that decision. And thank you, Rick, for that introduction about pointing out that what I do looks not just at what the individual bee does, but how collectively the bees together achieve a higher level entity. In this case, a swarm, which will be seen, makes a decision about its new home, and the swarm has a collective intelligence, and that's the theme of this talk today. I think you'll enjoy it at a couple of levels. One is the level at which the sheer level of these insects have to solve a problem of finding a place to live. We've all had to face that problem ourselves. We probably had to do it on our own. They do it collectively. I think you'll be intrigued by that difference and understanding the problem. It's also a talk that you can understand at the level of understanding how a group works together as a unit. I'll be coming back to this at the end, where I will review the tricks that they do to work together to make a good decision together. This is a problem we face a lot in our own lives, in our committees, coming up to a big election and so forth. Let's look at the end. We'll see how the bees do it, and then I'll share with you some of the things that I've learned from the bees and have implemented when serving as department chair to make my department work more like a hornet's nest, more like a beehive. Well, what do I mean by swarm intelligence? I mean this. It's the solving of a cognitive problem by two or more individuals who go out, collect information, and then process it through social interactions. And it, as you can imagine easily, it's a mechanism whereby individuals can overcome their own cognitive limitations. Grouping together, ability to collect information and process. What are some examples of swarm intelligence? Well, here's some human examples, the web search engines, Google and others, where you vote in favor of an interest of a site, identifies good sites, the H index, a measure of the impact your sciences have, Yelp.com for finding restaurants. How many people here have used Yelp, for example? Okay, so you've all voted, you've all been part of the collective intelligence of identifying good restaurants. What are some animal examples? Well, work now reveals that pigeons, when they choose their flight route homes, different individuals have different preferences, and collectively they average those to choose the most accurate route home. Baboons choosing a direction to move in the morning have a voting system. Ants choosing shortest travel routes. Now these all up here are actually rather simple systems. They're voting systems. There's not much pooling of information. There's very little discussion. When you vote on Yelp, it's just you're putting in a vote. Here we get into some interesting, more complicated discussion systems, and that the bees take that to an extreme, as you'll see. Now what's the history of the study of swarm intelligence? Well, I like to cite this early paper by Francis Galton back in 1907 from Nature called Vox Populi. And you can see, let's enjoy the first sentence together. In these democratic days, any investigation into the trustworthiness and peculiarities of popular judgments is of interest. It just sort of drips with skepticism, doesn't it? And what went on here, but his mind was changed from that skeptic to a supporter, because he went to an agricultural fair in southwest England where he saw this contest. The contest was one where if you put in 6 pence, about 2.50 today, you'd buy a little card and you'd put down your estimate of what the dressed weight of a live ox would be. That is to when that ox was converted to products that could be sold, What would you estimate? And he saw how this worked, and he got the cards when the contest was over from the person running it, and he did a statistical analysis of the results. And what did he find? To his amazement, the mean estimate of the weight was 197 pounds. The actual weight was 1198 pounds. He was blown away by this, and he ends his article by saying, "This result is, I think, more creditable to the trustworthiness of democratic judgment than might have been expected." So, nice early example. And that's just a simple one, because that's just averaging. People, the contest was set up so people really didn't compare notes. People came in at various times, put in their estimates. There wasn't, again, wasn't much discussion. What we're going to be looking at is a democratic judgment by a swarm of bees. Shown here. And our quest is to understand in detail how this group of bees solves a life or death cognitive problem. It's the life or death problem of finding a good sheltering place to live. I'll explain in a second why this is so important. And as Rick said before, I really do think of this like a brain. And I don't have time to go into it today, but there are remarkable parallels in the organization of which information is processed in this bee swarm and in the human brain to make simple perceptual decisions. When you decide to move left or right, the mechanisms are remarkably similar to what the bees have. Now, what is a swarm of bees? It is a reproductive propagule. They're produced in the spring, early summer, typically. They contain one queen bee and about 10,000 worker bees. And they've left their parental hive. They've gone out in a swirl. They've assembled on this tree branch, and they haven't yet chosen where they're going to live. They need to find a home. They need to find a hollow tree with the right sort of cavity. And how do they do this? Well, that's what the rest of the talk is about. It's based on a search committee of about several hundred scout bees. About 3 to 5% of the swarm is going to be active in this decision-making process. And these are among the oldest, most experienced bees. They've had the most experience flying out from the hive, foraging, coming back, finding their way back. And that's what they're going to have to do here. Only instead of going out to patches of flowers and foraging, they're going to be flying off, fanning out, and searching for potential home sites in the surrounding countryside. And they'll be searching out for miles and miles. What are they looking for? Well, I won't go into detail of how we know this. This is stuff I did for my PhD thesis research back in the 70s. But this is a dream home for honeybees, this sugar maple that used to be up in the woods near my house. What makes it a dream home is that it has a high entrance, high off the ground, and that makes it safe from predators, less likely to be found by predators. It has a small entrance, and that's important in the winter, so that when the cold wind doesn't blow through the nest. They like the cavity by virtue of its having a volume of about 40 liters, 10 gallons. And that gives them enough space to build their combs and store the honey that they need to get through the winter. And it has sturdy walls. It's in a live tree. And you can see this is actually a difficult combination of traits to find together. You've got to find a live tree with a big rotted cavity in it, a large cavity which is accessed through a small entrance opening, and to top it off, that entrance opening is high off the ground. Not easy for the bees to find, but very important for them to find. And that's probably why they send out several hundred bees searching. Now, why is it life and death? It's because good shelter and 20 kilograms of honey are essential. This is a thermal vision of a swarm, of a cluster of bees in their nest. And I show it just to emphasize the fact that inside their nest, they form a cluster, particularly in the winter, a tight cluster where they are producing heat. They have a heat production of about 40 watts all winter long inside this well-insulated cluster. They'll keep the temperature up above 80 degrees, typically often above 90 degrees, and that's how they survive winter. But to fuel that heat production, they're burning through about a pound of honey each week, sometimes even more. And so if they don't have a large cavity, they can't store up enough honey, or if they don't have a site that protects them against the wind, they will burn through their fuel supply even faster. So that's why they need this. They have to find the right home. Now, once a bee finds one of these sites. Each scout bee goes out, searches on her own. Most bees actually don't find anything, but a couple dozen of them will find potential home sites, tree cavities. And what does a bee do when she on her own, chances upon one? Well, she'll first conduct a private evaluation at the site of the thing that she's found. She goes inside, she makes a number of trips inside. This is an example from an experimental nest box where I tracked one individual bee as she moved around. Each scout bee makes multiple trips inside over about a half hour period. And as she gains experience, trip after trip inside, she walks around, flies around, she traverses more and more of the inner surfaces. And over time, in details I can't go through for lack of time, she will measure the volume and the entrance size and the height off the ground. And she is able to summarize this information into a sense of the overall goodness of the site that she's found. Now, after that half hour inspection, she then goes back to the swarm and makes a public report. She's going to report the direction of her discovery, the distance, and the quality of the discovery. And she does it with the famous waggle dance, where it's behavior where a bee on a vertical surface, such as on a comb here, but in the case of a scout bee, it'll be on the side of a swarm, will do a walk forward at a certain angle, waggle your body, stop after a certain period of time, come around, and waggle again. Let me show you what this looks like. Here's a scout bee on the surface of a swarm, dancing on the back of her sisters, waggles, stops, comes around, waggles, stops. She's consistent in the angle she points when she waggles, and each waggle run lasts about 2 seconds. 1001, 1002, and other bees tag along behind her. Other scout bees are getting her information. And as I say, she's indicating the direction and the distance, and as we'll see, the quality of what she found. The direction's indicated by the angle of that waggle run, that angle of the waggle run. In this case, the bee was dancing 40 degrees to the right of straight up. That represents a travel direction of 40 degrees to the right of the sun. The sun is the reference outside the hive. The straight up is the reference on the swarm or inside the hive. And the distance is indicated by the duration of each waggle run. And so we see it can go on for a couple seconds or a fraction of a second. And that codes the distance to the target, be it a food source or a prospective home. So she's come back. She's shared this information with other scout bees. Remember, there's several hundred scout bees, but only about two dozen of them find a prospective home site. So most of the scout bees will find out about possible home sites by listening to a dance of one of the successful scout bees. Now what happens? Well, let me first tell you that how we know that bees use their dance to indicate nest sites was worked out by this gentleman here, Martin Lindauer. He was a student of Carl von Frisch. Carl von Frisch deciphered the honeybee waggle dance, but he always studied it in the context of bees advertising food sources. Lindauer discovered that the bees are versatile in the use of the waggle dance. They use it also to indicate the location of prospective homes. And what happened is one day, Lindauer, working with von Frisch at the Zoological Institute in Munich, came out and saw a swarm of bees from one of the hives at the institute that had collected in a tree branch. And being a good observer, he noticed that bees were doing waggle dances on the surface of the swarm. He first thought, oh, okay, that's interesting. These bees, even when they're at a swarm, they're still foraging, bringing food to the swarm to keep it well nourished. But he noticed a couple of things that looked a little odd about these dancing bees. One is that they never had unloaded any food. They neither brought back pollen on their legs, nor did they regurgitate nectar to other bees. He thought that was odd. What was even odder, though, was some of the bees were really dirty. Some of them had grit, what looked like mortar dust on them, or dirt. And some were really black with soot. And Lindauer said he picked one of these black, sooty-looking bees off by the wings, sniffed it. He said it smelled like a chimney sweep. And that was his first indication that these bees were not coming back from flowers at all, but were coming back from places out in the city. Now, you have to remember this. I didn't explain this. He made these observations in 1949, so just a few years after the end of World War II. Munich had been heavily bombed during the war. Many of the buildings were just piles of rubble. And these scout bees and the swarm that he was watching were bees that had gone out in the city, found things like broken chimneys, smashed walls, things like that, and had found prospective home sites. But Lindauer didn't leave it there. He said, I really want to test my idea that those are indicating nest sites. So what did he do? He got permission from Frisch to just let some of these swarms sit there, because normally the beekeeper at the institute would collect the swarm and put it in a beehive. But he said, no, I want to really watch what goes on one of these swarms. Let me just sit by some swarms, watch their dances, and see what I see. And when he did this, he saw that initially bees perform dances for multiple sites, but before the swarm flies away, and this might be a few hours or a few days later, all of the dances were indicating just one site. And then Lindauer was able to run beneath the swarm as it flew away, because the swarm was only, the cloud is about the size of half the front of this room, and the top of the swarm is about head height. So you can stay with it, and it only goes about 5 or 6 miles an hour tops. You can run with it, and you can see that the swarm flies to this same site in the city that the consensus, the dance consensus was indicating. So for example, his first swarm that he tracked went 5 blocks to the north, and that corresponded exactly with what the dances indicated at the end, right before the swarm took off. So we can conclude that the dances on this swarm indicate possible home sites. He also had this lovely insight. He saw that this looked like this decision involved several hundred scout bees, and he said, it looks kind of like a democratic, he called it a plebiscite, but the basic idea was that bees have a democratic method of choosing a home. He could even put the queen inside a little cage, so he knew that the queen was not involved in this process. But that's where the story sat. He published this as his habilitation, his very special thesis in 1955. That's where the story sat until really 1997. Because what Lindauer was not able to really work out how they run their democratic method. And you have to understand why. And I talked to him about this. He said this was the most exciting discovery of his life, but he was never able to follow it through, especially not in the 1950s, because the tools he had available at that time were very basic. He had a notebook. He had a pencil. He had a chair. He had a wristwatch for noting the time of day. He had a stopwatch for timing the dances. And he had a little paint set for putting dots of paint on the bees. That's all he had. And there's, as you'll see, it gets to a point where there's lots of dances going on simultaneously on a swarm. He just couldn't watch what was happening and find the tail. So, as I say, till the mid-90s, that's where the story sat. And I knew about Lindauer's work. I was intrigued by it. And in the mid-90s, I decided to have a go at it. And what I did to start was I wanted to do a detailed eavesdropping on the scout bees debate on a swarm, taking advantage of video technology, which of course had developed in the intervening time. And to do this, I would make a swarm of bees where each bee is labeled for individual identification with a little license plate on the thorax and a paint mark on the abdomen. You could label 4,000 bees. It only takes about 10 hours to do that if you have a team of helpers, students, and put it up on a special swarm mount so that the video camera will record it very nicely. And then you just play back the videotapes, and from this I would know everything that went on in that debate. I knew which bees were involved, I knew what site each bee indicated, I knew where that site was, I knew how many times she danced for it, et cetera, et cetera. And what I want to, and this is the most important slide, I want to walk you through a debate that occurred on one swarm, this typical swarm. It unfolded over 16 hours to make the decision. 16 hours of dancing, I should say. Involved 11 sites and 149 scout bees. I want each of these, so I want to go through this in detail. What it is for each of these 8 panels, it represents the pattern of dancing, waggle dancing, or advertising by scout bees that was observed during that 2-hour time period. The circle in the middle of each rectangle indicates the swarm. Each arrow indicates advertising of a site. The direction of the arrow indicates the direction to the advertised site. north, south, east, west, etc. The length of the arrow indicates how far away the site is, inferred from the dance. And the width of the arrow indicates how many bees during that 2-hour time period performed a dance to advertise that site. In a sense, how many bees voted for that site during that block of time. You can see initially, the debate started around 11 o'clock on the morning, the 20th of July. And over those 2-hour time period, there were several different sites that were advertised in various directions and various distances. During the second 2-hour time period, same sort of thing happened, but more sites are being mentioned. It's gotten up to 8 different sites. Now, third 2-hour time period, same sort of thing. A variety of sites are still being advertised. At the end of the day, between 5 and 7 p.m., there's still a diversity of sites being advertised by dancing scout bees, but most of the action, most of the attention is going to a site to the south and a site to the southwest. So clearly they hadn't reached an agreement by the end of the first day. Things picked up the next morning where they left off the previous day. The site to the south and southwest were getting most of the votes. But and then little by little over the morning, the site to the southwest starts to gain the majority. By the end of the morning, it's gotten a strong majority, but it started raining at 11:54, and the whole thing shut down until the next morning. The rain just ended overnight, the sun came out. The next morning, every bee that danced on that swarm, all 73 bees that danced to the southwest, and the bees took off at the end of the morning and flew to the southwest to that site. So I show this because it gives you a nice overview, I think, of how the debate or decision making starts by putting lots of options on the table, and then step by step they winnow it down to one choice. Now I haven't said how they do this at all. I'm just trying to show you the pattern. You know, not I'm talking here about pattern, not process. Let me ask if there are any questions, because I want to make sure this pattern is clear to folks. So yes.
In the earlier slide you said they danced for 3 things and the last one was quality. You didn't mention how they
did the
quality.
I'll get to that.
Okay.
Stay tuned. Any other questions? Yes.
Do any of the watchers ever go check for themselves, or it's all communicated in the hive?
It's
in the swarm.
What happens is if one scout bee follows the dance of another scout bee, she is then recruited to that site. She gets the information, goes out, checks the site herself. If she likes it, if she agrees that it's worth dancing for, she will then come back and advertise it herself. And that's how interest grows and grows for one of these sites. Other questions? Okay. Now, they've come to an agreement. That's pretty remarkable in it itself. But what's even more remarkable is that the agreement is on the best site. Best site. It's not just building a consensus, but building a good consensus. Now, how do I know that they settle on the best site? I know it because I could test their decision-making ability by going to this place here, Appledore Island, Maine. It's a 90-acre island where Cornell has the Shoals, it's Shoals Marine Laboratory. This is an island. You go to Boston, but you hang a left, go up to Portsmouth, New Hampshire, take a ferry, go out to these islands. They're 6 miles out. The island is only 90 acres, so it's a small island. There are no bees on it, so it provides isolation. It's well off the mainland. And the key feature of this island is it has no trees. It has strong winds, which isn't good. Poison ivy, that's not good. Seagulls, that's cool, but not good for bee work. But the key thing is it has no trees. It has no natural nest sites. So I could take a swarm of bees out to this island, and I had control. This was my laboratory for now analyzing this system. The poor bees now have to choose among experimental nest boxes. Now, what am I going to do with that situation? Well, I'm a professor. I know it's not right to do multiple choice tests, but that's what I'm going to do. That's what I did with the scout bees. I mean, set up a swarm on the center of the island. Here's one of these swarms mounted on the swarm mount. And out on one side of the island, I'm going to give them an array of choices. Now, of these 4, there's one that's the correct choice. It's like A through E. One of those is a very good nest box. It's an excellent home site. The other 4 are only mediocre nest boxes. And the question is, how well could swarms solve that problem? Because I could do this test over and over again with different swarms. And here's how I would manipulate the quality of the sites. This is what these nest boxes look like. We saw earlier that a good, an ideal nest site is one that has 40 liters, and that's the size of this box. If this inner wall isn't here, I would put a small entrance here, so that would be good. This is what it looks like on the outside. So if there's no inner wall, it's 40 liters, and it's a good home for the bees. If I put the inner wall at 15 liters, it makes it okay for the bees. They'll accept it. It's acceptable, but it's not as good as 40 liters. And so the question, so four boxes would be set at 15 liters, and one would be set at 40 liters. And I don't want to go through it in detail, but this illustrates the kind of result that I would get. I put out five nest boxes. I would keep track, measure the number of scout bees at each nest box every 30 minutes, measure how many scouts were visible outside the nest box. And you can see that, say, in this first trial, they quickly discover all the four mediocre boxes a little after 8 a.m. in the morning. Found this one, found this one, found this one. Started to get interested in this one, and found this one. At noon, a little after noon, they found this one, the good one, and the numbers built up quickly here, went down of all the other ones eventually, and they chose that one. They took off and moved to that. Same thing in the next trial. Again, they found two of the mediocre sites first, but then went, and they started really getting interested in this one. But eventually, once they found this good one, the number of scout bees built up there more rapidly, more strongly, and they chose that one. And we've done this almost 20 times now. They've gotten it right every time except for one, and I'll come back to why they missed it in that one time. So they're pretty good at making this decision. Now, this makes, one thing I want to explain now is this kind of looks like doing this experimental work is like clockwork. It sounds like, oh, just put up a swarm, put up the nest boxes, things work automatically. It wasn't quite that simple. Let me explain why. The island does not have trees. The island does not have bees until I bring them out there. It has the nest boxes that I put out. So I figured, okay, I'll do this, I'll set it up. And when I started out, I set up the nest boxes. I was down at the nest boxes waiting for scout bees to appear. I wanted to see the first one, see what was going to happen. And I waited and waited, and no scout bees arrived. So I was wondering, where are my bees? So I think, okay, well, I'm going to go back. Maybe they have some reason they're not scouting. I'll go back to the swarm and see if there's any activity on the swarm. Is anybody doing any dances? Well, I go back to the swarm, and my goodness, yes, they were dancing like crazy, but not in the for a sight in the direction of my nest box, and the exact opposite. And they were pointing. I carefully measured, got my stopwatch out, timed the dances, measured the angle, checked the sun direction, plotted it out on my topo map, and the dances were going for this house. Now, this was bad news, folks, because when I came onto the island, I was told, Tom, you can go anywhere. Cornell leases the whole island except for this, this house here. And you should not go near that house. Why should I not go near that house? Well, this is the house of Rodney Sullivan, lobster fisherman, who is kind of a, you could say, crusty. He values his privacy and he enforces his privacy with a shotgun loaded behind his door. And he'd been known to shoot it off over people that were starting to get too close to his house. What did my scout, I didn't know it at the time, but they had, scout bees had discovered his chimney, it's like Lindauer scout bees. They found a chimney that they liked. But I didn't know that at first, so I went to the director of the lab, Jack Kingsbury. I said, Jack, what am I going to do? I think my bees are going over to Rodney Sullivan's house. And he said, well, we're going to have to go by boat. You can't walk over there. They were sneaking up on him, and you may shoot us. So let's go by boat. We'll call up. So we did that, went over, called up. Rodney, you home? He says, yeah, I'm home. Come on up. I got a problem. I got bees. I've never seen anything like it before. I was happy to tell him, well, I can, just by chance, I can help you with this problem. We came up with a solution. He had a ladder and some old window screen and some duct tape. So we built a fire in his wood stove, smoked out the scout bees. I climbed up on his roof and screened off the top of his chimney. And now the scout bees were, now the island really was, didn't have any natural nest sites. And those of you that are beekeepers know that, you probably wouldn't be surprised, they developed a good relationship with Rodney Sullivan. Because every time after that, I went back to Appledore, I'd bring some jars of honey. It really goes a long way. Sort of sweetening, sweet-talking a person. Well, now we need to drop down. We looked at what a swarm as a whole does. Now we need to drop down a level, like Rick said, from the swarm, whole swarm, down to the individual bees. What's going on at the level of the individuals to produce that collective decision-making, to choose the best site? And we've got to solve two problems. One is, and illustrated by what we've seen, the bee's interest grows and grows for the best site. How did that happen? And we can see, just to review, the winning site, the best site in this decision, started out at 13% of the votes, or dances, went up to 33%, then it grew to 62%, finally it got to 100%. What happened? How did it get ahead? How did it keep growing? And we also need to figure out, how does the bee's interest, and this is perhaps even more remarkable, how did the bee's interest fade for all those other sites? I mean, this site to the south, which was competing very well, was even a little bit ahead at the end of the first day, somehow all of the bees that were enthusiastic about it went quiet, stopped their dancing. What happened there? Well, so how can we, so those are the two questions we'll address. Well, one way to think of this and to begin to understand it is to think of this democratic decision-making process as like, a bit like a democratic election. You've got different sites, which are, and they're candidates in this election, site A, site B, candidate A, candidate B. You've got supporters for each site. These are the scouts that are committed to site A or site B. You've got a pool of uncommitted voters, uncommitted scouts, and the individuals that are committed to one site or the other, they want to attract, they perform advertisements, in the case of bees, these are waggle dances, to attract bees from this pool of uncommitted individuals over to supporters for their site. So that's the heart of the process. Now we'll see how they do this, and of course the question is, how is it that the best site gets the greatest number of supporters? Well, one thing that's important to this is, we'll see, is that the advertising is biased in favor of the better site. The better the site, the stronger the advertisements are. The stronger the dancing, and this comes back to your question, the stronger the dancing for that site. And so a key feature of honeybee elections is honest advertising of the candidates. Now, how do I know that they're honest? That is to say, how do I know that they perform a stronger signaling for better sites? I know it by asking them. We know it because we could go back to Appledore, and a lot of this work I did with Kirk Vischer down at UC Riverside. We go back to Appledore. Now we put a swarm up on the porch of another building, but here now we're just going to put out two nest boxes. One's going to be high value, 40 liter, the other medium value, 15 liter. We're going to just put out the boxes, put up the swarm. We're not going to label any of the bees on the swarm until a bee shows up at one of the boxes. And now we're going to label the bees at the boxes. The bees from this box are going to get a yellow label. The bees from this box are going to get a pink label, for example. So now we've got two groups of bees coming back from two sites that differ in quality. They're coming back to the same swarm at the same time, and we're going to look at their dances, and we're going to see how their dances differ. Because there's got to be something about those dances that are different to bias, to get more recruitment to the better site. And what we focused on is how many dance circuit each scout bee produced. A dance circuit is this waggle, and one waggle run followed by a return run. That's one dance circuit. So we video record the dances of these bees coming back from each site and see what we would see. Give you a feel for how this works. Here's what it looks like on the island. There's two sites. The swarm is 250 meters over in that direction. There's one person stationed here, another person stationed at that box. One's the fixer-upper, one's the dream home. We label the scout bees. I think you'll like this. We label them just by putting an insect net over the entrance of the nest box. You see a bee go in, when she comes out, she flies into the insect net. You gently pin her between the folds of the net, put a paint dot on her. You might think that this would freak the bee out. It turns out it doesn't. You let the bee out of the insect net, what does the bee do? She just flies around and goes back in the next box to make her next visit to inspect the box. So So I like to call this method of labeling individuals abduction by aliens, because that's what the bee has happened to the bee. And we all know that whenever anybody's abducted by aliens, you have no memory of the bee. It's true for the bees, too. I mean, does anybody here remember being abducted by aliens? Okay, honest advertising by scout bees. Well, here is what I mean by this. We've got, this is the distribution of dance circuits per bee for the two sites, the dream home at the top. At the dream home, you can see that there was 41 bees, we got data on the dream home, 437 for the fixer upper. You can see that these are very broad distributions, but for the dream home bees, there are a few that did more than 200 dance circuits to advertise the site. Many did more than 100, some did less than 100. The mean average value is 90 dance circuits to advertise the better site. Among the fixer-upper, nobody did more than 200, only a few did more than 100, many did less than 100, and many, many did zero dance circuits. And their average was only 30 dance circuits. So overall, the higher a bee judges a site's quality, the longer she dances. And that's it. It's nothing else in that dance, it turns out to be. It's not more vigorous, it's not more enthusiastic, it's not more vivacious, it's not wider arcs in the waggles. It's just how many dance circuits the bee performs. And why does that work? It's because when a bee follows a dancing bee, she only needs to follow a few dance circuits, maybe 5 to 10, to get the information and then go out and find the site. So if a bee does 90 dance circuits, a lot of bees can follow that. That's enough for, even if it's just one bee at a time is following the dance, that's enough for more than 16 bees, say, to get the information from the dancer. But if she only does 30, that's only enough for about 5 to get the information. So that's going to, just doing a longer circuit is going to give more opportunity for other bees to get the information. So you can think of this process. I tried to show it schematically here. This isn't quite the full story, as we'll see, but it's much of it. If we have two sites, a poor site over here on the left, because it's got a large entrance, and a better site over here, and imagine just the simplest, very simplest situation, that both sites are discovered at exactly the same time, and each one's discovered by one scout bee, of course. They both come back to the swarm at the same time, but the bee coming back from the better site does 90 dance circuits, typical the average for a good site, 30 for the mediocre site. Well, what happens if you come back 3 hours later? Now you're going to have 3 times as many bees recruited to this site as to this site. So you'll have 3 times as many bees dancing for this site relative to this site. And now the thing starts to snowball in favor of this site, because now you have 3 times, each of these blue bees is dancing 3 times as strongly, but now there's 3 times as many of them. So, and then you came back 3 hours later, the thing's going to be even more biased in favor of this better site. Almost all of the bees are going to be dancing, and there's going to be a strong buildup here and only a weak buildup here. So this, I hope this gives you a sense of the kind of way this positive feedback can, just by changing that dance, strength of dancing, you can bias the population buildup in favor of one site or the other. You might be wondering, okay, I presented this as an idea of like, it's like an election or a popularity contest, which is what an election is. But how exactly do you win an election here? You know, we win our elections because when somebody counts up the votes. But how does it work in a bee swarm? I've stressed the idea, because this is what you see on a swarm, that you might win it by becoming the consensus choice site on the swarm. Because that's what you see, especially if you watch it from the video recordings. You can see that they build a clean consensus, generally. But another possibility is that it's not something that's happening at the swarm, because something else is happening during this whole process. You might win the contest if a critical or quorum of bees builds up at one of the sites. So to go back to this schematic, the question was, what matters to the bees? How do the bees know that this site is won? Is it because nearly all of the bees are dancing to indicate that site? Or is it because They're sensing that there's been a strong buildup of bees at this site. And what made me think of this is I never ever saw a scout bee. For this to work, it would involve the scout bees walking around polling the other dancers. And that would be hard to do, because these dances stop and start, stop and start. It's hard to get, it would be hard to think for a bee to get sense. And it turns out that what really matters is this. This decision making is a race between these competing evidence totals. And it turns out that the evidence that it counts in this whole thing is the number of bees that are built up at the sites. This site over here competed better. It raced, it won the race to get to a critical number of scout bees first, this quorum. We call this quorum sensing. So reaching a quorum is equal to winning the contest. And I don't have time to go through it, but I'll just give you a hint of how we experimentally demonstrated that. It involved setting up 5 nest boxes in the same site. They're all, the bees don't, in doing their dances, they don't resolve those 5 nest boxes that are in my 5 iron shelters there. When they do it, whichever of those 5 nest boxes they go to, when they get back to the swarm and they do a dance, it's the same as if they, for all of these sites, the dance is not that directionally precise. And so in a situation like this, we would find that we would, by putting out 5 boxes in the same site, this would cause the scout bees to spread themselves out among those 5 boxes. The whole decision making would be slowed down because the quorum is not building up as rapidly at any one of the sites. So we know that reaching a quorum is what determines which site wins the contest. And I should have known this way back when I was doing these tests of their decision-making ability. And because is that when I looked back at it, and I actually even recall sensing this when I was doing these experiments, that whenever this number of scout bees that were visible at one of the sites reached about 15 bees outside the box, then the swarm would take off and move to that site. So. Look, we don't know how a quorum is sensed. We don't know how the bees are measuring how many fellow scout bees are at her site, whether it's by contacts or visual or chemical cues. We don't know, but somehow when it gets to that level, that tells the bees that site wins. So I've taken you up to the point almost of how they make their decision. And tomorrow I'm going to tell you what they do. Once that quorum is reached, that actually triggers those scout bees from that site. Once they get to this point, once a quorum has been reached, this tells the bees to actually change gears. They're no longer in decision-making mode. They need to implement the decision. And that's what tomorrow's talk is about. There's another part of this story that referred to already, and that is that the bees, we've talked about how the interest grows and grows for the best sites, but how does the bees, scout bees' interest fade for all the poorer sites? And I think we probably all know from our own committee meetings that can be the more difficult thing to observe and achieve. Well, here you have to go back and see what the individual bees are doing. And if you do this, this is a complicated slide, but I'll try to explain it clearly. These are the time records of 5 different scout bees. They've been labeled by name according to their color of their paint mark. For each bee, there's a timeline. And on the timeline, the black diamond below the timeline means the bee is at the nest box and sighted at the nest box. There's a bar above the timeline, it means she's been sighted back at the swarm. So this red bee is the bee that, in this experiment, she discovered the nest box. She spent a while there checking it out, inspecting it. She came back to the swarm, and what's indicated by this red oval with a number in it, that's how many dance circuits she did. She came back, she was very excited about that nest box, came back, danced for it, and then she left the swarm, went back to the nest box, and then she came back to the swarm. But the next time she came back to the swarm, she didn't dance at all. She just went quiet, and then she went back to the nest box, and then she came back to the swarm again, and again she didn't dance. She never danced again. So that bee, she didn't follow any other dances. She just went quiet. And the other bees that she recruited with her dance did basically the same thing. That's what all these bees, all of these bees followed her dance, were recruited in the nest box, and they did the same thing. They spent a while at the box, checking it out, coming back to the swarm. With different levels of excitement, they danced for it, and went back to the nest box, came back to the swarm. They, again, their interest in dancing for the site faded. So all of these scouts, each scout, we've watched this for many, many scout bees, gradually stops dancing and visiting her site. And it's even before she's learned of a better or second site. She's not going around and comparing her site to others. This is, something's going on here. And no comparing of sites and switching to better ones. These bees just, it's like they go out, they check it out, they come back, they vote for it, or they support it, but then they go quiet. They say, okay, I've done my thing, I'm gonna go quiet now. I'll pass it on to the decision-making to the next individuals, next generation. Now, but why do these bees lose their interest in a site? For many years, I thought this was just an intrinsically driven process, much like many of our sensory neurons have a phasic response. They fire for a while, and they just stop firing eventually. And that serves functions in the nervous system. I thought that's maybe what was going on. But I did wonder, are some of these bees perhaps encouraged to stop their dancing? Is there any inhibitory signaling in this process? A kind of, to use the election camp analogy, is there any negative campaigning? Are bees from advocating one site dissing bees advertising yet another site? And it turns out there is. We learned about this just 2 summers ago, and I kick myself for not checking this out long before. But on the other hand, I comfort myself by knowing that bees have been doing this signal for millions of years, and we're the first ones to discover it. So we're a little slow, but a little bit late, but at least we finally found it. Now, what happens is this bee, while she's dancing away, every once in a while, a bee from another site is going to come up and butt her with her head, boom, butt against her, usually around her head or her thorax. And this is what we call the stop signal or beep signal. We call it the beep signal because it's very short. It's like a little beep, beep. It's a kind of high-pitched frequency. Butts the dancer with the head while beeping. And so the beeps are made by the bee that's doing the beeping activates her flight muscles while pushing her head against the dancer. And I think they do this beep to make it clear to that dancer, you're not just being bumped accidentally, but you're getting a signal. And 50% of the waggle dancers on a swarm get beeped. They typically get some of those that get beeped, it's between 3 and 20 beeps, and usually after about 10 beeps, the bee will stop dancing. So it's not every bee gets beeped, not every bee stops dancing because she's been beeped, but it turns out about half of them do, and it's an important part of the process. What I'd like to show you now is a movie that shows you this beeping process. What we're going to watch and play the movie is this bee with the yellow and blue is going to be doing a waggle dance, minding her own business, and you're going to see another bee with a pink paint mark come in from the top and come up and beep that bee, ram her. I guess the sound is enough. Let's do that.
Maybe you can adjust. You maxed out on the sound.
I maxed on the computer.
I think I have the sound maxed out.
There we go. One, two. Here it is. Part of the reason we missed it is it's very soft. There's a microphone right here. You can see even with a microphone right up there, it's not really loud. You have to use the microphone to hear it. And it's because in the nature, they're not loading the energy into the air, they're loading it into the bee. Now, the remarkable thing is that when they do this beeping, they're creating cross-inhibition between the different groups of scout bees. So we know this from an experiment. We set up a swarm, put out 2 nest boxes, labeled the boxes from one site with yellow paint marks, marked the scouts from the other box with pink paint marks, and then we watched on the swarm who is beeping who? And this top distribution shows over time who was the yellow, the beeps that were received by the yellow dancers, and most of the beeps came from pink beeps. Now who was, this shows what the pink dancers received, they're receiving beeps mostly from yellow bees. And so this is, creates a, each group are inhibiting each other. Now what's the logic of this? Why have this cross inhibition? Well, for this I worked with some mathematicians in England who study the basically the physics of decision making in nervous systems, but now they got interested in understanding the physics of decision making in the bee swarm. And we know enough about this process so we can fill out what they call their mean field population level equations, where you can know the probability of the bee doing a dance, getting beeped, stopping dances, etc. Put it into these equations. And what it reveals is that if the bees had beeping, and what these plots show is the proportion of the scout bees affiliated with either site, starting with site, this would be the proportion of bees with for site A, it goes from 0 to 1, or site B, 0 to 1. And wherever you start, and if you start out, let's say they didn't, they beep, but they do it indiscriminately. They don't cross and hit it. They don't go for the other group. What happens is the system ends up in a deadlock. Wherever you start on this, you're going to go out, you're going to end up with 50-50 if the two sites are equal. If, on the other hand, you do discriminant beeping, so that you inhibit, you cross, you inhibit dancing by the group bees at the other site, what happens is you can start out 50-50, but just if a little bit of noise takes one site a little bit ahead of the other in terms of number of scout bees, it'll push it in favor of that site. And so the consensus of the dancing will go to that site. It could be either site. So this helps, this cross inhibition helps them avoid a deadlock in the very difficult situation where you have to choose between two good alternatives. And I think we've all experienced this in the grocery store. Do I want this can of soup or this one? They both look good. You're having trouble making the decision. But it also helps the process, it speeds up the process if the two alternatives are different. So if site B is better, they would have probably gotten to that site anyhow, but with this cross-inhibition, it pushes, it propels the consensus in favor of that of the better site. So the theoretician said they hadn't incorporated this kind of thing in their decision-making circuits yet. They said, smart bees. So what we know now is that, I've elaborated on the schematic a little bit. Here's these two sites, and now what I filled in is, it starts out, again, with just two bees advertising their site, but this is group one, and we've seen now that that group one bees goes quiet after a while. At one, so that's at 10 o'clock. At 1 o'clock, it's a different group of bees now that is dancing. It's the bees that were recruited by the first ones. And then, 4 p.m., it's still a different group of scout bees. And we now understand that this site wins, not because just because they do excited, stronger excitatory signals for this site, but as soon as they get a little bit ahead here, they start to suppress the dancing for the other site. So that sharpens up their decision making. I won't go through this. If I had time, I'd explain how it's parallel to decision making in the vertebrate brains for our simple perceptual decisions. What I do want to sum up, end with, though, with is reviewing what we can learn about building swarm intelligence. That is to say, how can a group of individuals, each with limited information and limited intelligence, i.e. a committee members, achieve a high collective IQ? Well, what are the bees doing? These are some of the sort of things that I've abstracted out of this process, which I remind myself when I try to make a committee work well. What the bees have going for them is the group members share a decision-making goal, and very helpfully, they share their preferences. They don't have bedrock differences in their preferences. It's not like Republicans and Democrats. They all know what makes a good nest site, like as if we all knew what makes a good president. And they share a decision-making goal. But that actually, the first part of that applies very much to humans, because even though you come into a meeting, you might have different preferences, you all might share the same goal of hiring the best person. And the person running the meeting might remind people of that. The other thing the bees, another thing the bees do well is they arrange it so that the group, the members of the group possess diverse information. In the case of the bees, they send scout bees everywhere. So they go out, find very different things, come back and report. So if you were trying to make, put together a good decision-making committee, you might try to draw on people with different pieces of knowledge about the problem that's being addressed. Third thing, the group members in the swarm contribute their information freely. Any bee, whatever she finds, she can come back and report on it. She doesn't feel there's no censoring of information. They can come back, they found something that's worth advertising, they will. And so in a group meeting, you might encourage people to say, well, what are your ideas? And let's list them on the board. Get them out on the table. Fourth thing the bees do well is they have the members evaluate the options independently and they vote independently. That is to say, these scout bees, when you think back about what they're doing, a bee goes out, evaluates a site independently. No bee ever follows, gets excited about a site because she saw another bee excited about a site. She uses the dance information from another bee to find the site, but her own evaluation of the site is based on her own inspection of the site. And when they vote, which as we've seen is actually a matter of spending time at the site, that's based on their own assessment of the site's goodness. So there's no mindless copying. And that's very important because it means that a site will only get a lot of support if a lot of independent minds will vote in favor of it. And that means in a committee meeting, you might want to make sure you have secret ballots so people really feel like they can vote their minds freely, independently. And the last thing the bees do is they aggregate their votes in a fair way. One vote per person, majority rule, or what bees do is a kind of quorum sensing, whichever one gets above some threshold level of popularity. These are the things that the bees do, and I know it seems odd to kind of use insects as management gurus, but these things really do work, and they've become part of the culture of my academic department. We have now a new chairman, and every time we get sort of stuck in a meeting, Craig Abbott will turn to me and say, well, Tom, what would the bees do in this situation? And often, I can give him an answer. So. That's the story as much as I could tell of it in this time. I do want to point out that I had a lot of people that I enjoyed working with to work this out. Madeline Beekman in Sydney, Australia, and others, Nigel Franks, James Marshall, and Thomas Schlegel from England on the theory parts of things, especially Kurt Fisher. And it took many undergraduate helpers to man the nest boxes and the graphics, our thanks to Margaret Nelson. Artist that I've worked with for many years. Thank you very much. If you have questions, I'll... I guess I was a little long-winded, but if there's time for questions, I'll be happy to...
Why aren't people who need to go department, let's spend 5 to 10 minutes on questions. I'll let you field the question.
Yes. So do you know anything about the... say previous history of the scout bees or anything about their age group or any of that sort of stuff?
The question was, what do we know about these scout bees? All we know now is their age, there's two things we know. We know their age distribution. They are among the oldest bees, very extremely old bees in the colony. The other thing that we know about them is we've done some genomics analysis. They are bees that, this doesn't explain the cause, but it shows what they are. They have certain... They have genes tuned up in their brain they've tuned up their reward system. And this is actually typical in vertebrates of individuals that like novelty. If you get a real surge out of learning something new, if you get a real surge out of that, that's associated in humans with rewards for strong rewards, and that's associated with novelty. So that's what these bees have. It's a remarkable similarity. But that's as far as we know, Kim. I wish I knew more. Yes, Sarah.
I really wanted to hear what you were going to say about the monkey brain and swarm intelligence.
Come to dinner.
just in a nutshell, in both cases, it's a race of evidence. You've got inputs, How much is the predator approaching from the left or from the right? Your nervous system gets inputs about both of those things. It might be feeling pressure waves or seeing something. But if it's coming in from the right, the evidence builds up faster for that it's about the right. And you get above a threshold, the next level of the brain fires and it takes it to implementation. There's a logic here. It's probably the most basic and perhaps most powerful way, this evidence race, and these are called race models, the mathematicians, of pooling, of aggregating information when nobody gets an overview of it. You just have a race and you see which population gets to an activity, critical activity level first. And I didn't have time to stress it, but if you go through this, if you tune these systems right, this actually will produce statistically optimal decision making. That is to say, for a given level of accuracy, it will get you there fastest, or for a given amount of time, it will give you the highest level of accuracy. We haven't tested that with the bees, but that's what the theory indicates. And I love the fact that they're both about 1.5 kilograms, a swarm of bees and a... That's just fun. Yes, in the back there.
Yeah, the bees seem to vary a lot in their ability to evaluate the nest boxes. So is that, are some consistently smarter than the others, or is there something that correlates with the ability to actually evaluate? Because even when the nest boxes are really good, some of them don't answer.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, there's a tremendous variation in the tendency to dance. So some, even going to an excellent home site, come back and don't dance. And I don't know what that's about. Fortunately, this system works on a lot of averaging. It's averaged over time. And that may be part of the reason. There may not be a lot of selection to get real precision reporting. And if you're a neuroscientist, you know that's how it works with sensory neurons as well. A lot of noise in your reporting. Yes?
You were talking about the independent evaluation being important. With the blues and the pinks towards the end of the presentation,
yes.
Did you see if any of the pinks visited the blue box?
No. If they had visited, they would have gotten two paint marks.
Two paint marks, okay.
Nope, they don't. That shows how really you don't, really, when I say limited knowledge, this system is working with individuals with very limited knowledge. Mm-hmm. No comparisons. Mm-hmm. Yes?
Are the bees that are more enthusiastic about dancing also more enthusiastic about telling their rivals to hush up?
That's what we're trying to look at next. Is this, do bees that have visited a good site, do they make stronger inhibitory signals? I don't know. The mathematicians say, no, it's not necessary. In fact, it may not help, but we'll find out. Yes?
This beeping, is this also found in the other context in which we use waggle dances, or is it unique to the situation you're describing?
It's also used in foraging. It's used also in foraging. If a bee goes out to a patch of flowers and experiences danger there, or if she, perhaps more importantly, if she tries to rob from another hive and gets beat up, and she sees somebody else dancing from the same place, they will inhibit that dancer. It's still, the context of foraging is less clear, though, I think.
So that sort of leads to the second question, which is, do you think the bees sort of co-opted the waggle dance for this, for the person finding a hive, or do you think, which came first, the waggle dance for finding a home? Or
it's really hard to answer that, Phil. It's hard to say. I don't know. I know I, as an as a phylogenetically oriented individual, evolutionary origins is tough on that one. I'm sorry. I can't see logically either in favor of either one. Yes.
And along the same lines, do you think the honeybee dance is limited to these channels of information in terms of angle, direction, frequency?
Yeah.
Or are there more ways?
Well, we there's sort of two questions there. How is the information encoded, and how is it, what kind of information is in there? People have looked for other forms of it, kinds of information in there. Do they indicate in height off the ground, for example? Nothing else has been found besides distance and direction, and now quality. There is the bee, as she does her dance, she's releasing floral scents if she's coming back from a food source, so there's that, but that's not really signaled in the dance, that's just a kind of an incidental cue. So though it's in terms of actual information that's encoded in that dance behavior, we only know about those three. And how exactly, a big mystery is how the bees decode that dance information. And I know about you, but as I was talking about with Sarah earlier, I still find it mind-boggling that a bee on a swarm can follow the dance of another bee and fly off potentially 2 or 3 miles to and find the tree on a hillside, one tree out of thousands of trees on that hillside, and find the knot hole in that tree and discover that site herself. Now, it's true that the scouts who have that find a site will mark that site with a pheromone, but still, it's an impressive feat of communication. Yes, Gabby.
I was interested in your quorum effect, and I was wondering if you'd ever tested more than one swarm at a time.
Yeah, we have done that. We are nasty experimentalists as well. And when you do that, you can set up 2 swarms, one with genetic markers so they're yellow and the other so they're black and their body colors. And what you see is they fight like fury over that one nest box that's on Appledore. Whichever site, and initially they'll both be there, but as soon as one group gets a little bit ahead of another, and you're right, there is like a quorum response here too. As soon as the scout group from one gets a little bit above in the size of the other group, they will pounce on them and kill them. And once they've killed off the scouts from that other site, they will then guard that site. They'll post guards there all night. This is a really important, finding a good home is a very important resource. Yeah. So these are very cooperative.
Let's take one more.
Yes.
So what causes the
bees?
There were some bees that was dancing for the same site they had visited.
Yeah.
What causes that? I can see the other ones that are,
yeah,
feel they have a better site, but those ones you're saying, they've changed their mind?
No, thank you for asking that question. It gets into the stage of, they've actually made the decision. It's pretty clean up to the point where they've reached the quorum. Once the quorum is reached, then the bees beep indiscriminately. Because now, once the quorum's reached, they don't need any more recruitment. In fact, they want to shut off the waggle dancing. And that's kind of what this blue arrow indicates. I don't show the whole
thing. So they're just trying to stop the whole process.
They're trying to stop all of the waggle dancing. They're trying to shut off recruitment. They don't need that. They need to get into the next, they need to get on to moving to the home.
That's what we need for our election.
So I have one last question that I would love to ask, and that is, do you have beepers at your faculty meetings and do a lot of
that? That's a wonderful question, right? And yes, there is. And I've never been asked that question, but it's perfect because it points out that, yes, in a human discussion, people say, well, I'm not sure I agree with that. And that doesn't necessarily stop the first person who was advocating an alternative to stop dancing. It might, if they heard that time and time again, they had 10 people said it to them, they might go quiet on their idea. But in the end, even though there is this beeping and putting down of another person, in the end, each bee can still vote what it thinks. So, yes, there is.
So I hate to beep and buzz, but thanks, Tom. It was great. If you want to hear more great stuff,